item on our agenda is to discuss touring OYA with...
It's not for us, it's for the viewers.
Karen Brazo, and the idea would be to do this on the 8th during committee time, the 8th of March. Is everyone interested in that? And we would be back hopefully... Karen, how long would it take to tour that facility? Can we do it in 2 hours?
That would be plenty of time.
Thank...
The travel time is about realistically, if you want to stay within the law, 30 minutes.
Yeah, of course we want to stay within the law.
OYA?
Yes, McLaren.
Oh, you're going to McLaren?
Yes. Okay, anybody not interested in going? Okay, we'll plan that then for our committee time on the 8th. We'll be visiting your facility there, McLaren. Okay, so we'll start now a public hearing on Senate Bill 384. And Mickey, are you first up?
Actually, Donna.
Okay, Donna?
384. You know, human nature tells me it'll work.
My gosh, I just spent the morning with Donna a good percentage of the time.
But I tried to tell you how many places...
The success out of that stuff, we have really sometimes very poor groups. I mean, in size more than public employees. They come out more times than not. And even if they don't, you know, then the Supreme Court just...
Okay, Ms. Middleton, just go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
No more paper.
Have at it.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, my name is Donna Middleton. I'm the Director of the Commission on Children and Families. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 384. This is a bill that transfers some responsibility for juvenile justice matters to both the Oregon Youth Authority and the Criminal Justice Commission. A number of months ago, the governor, through executive order, transferred all of the programs and funds for juvenile services activities from the Commission on Children and Families to the Criminal Justice Commission and Oregon Youth Authority. And these are pieces of statute that continue to hold some responsibility for the commission around juvenile justice activities. And we have met with both the Oregon Youth Authority and the Criminal Justice Commission, and all have agreed to this legislation today. It is my understanding that Karen Brazo has some amendments to this legislation. However, it continues to support the efforts to change the placement of the juvenile services projects from the commission to both those agencies. And so I'm here to testify that we have worked together to develop this legislation and am in support of this legislation.
Okay. Did all the money follow?
The only money that currently has not fallen is the court subsidies dollars. Those dollars were supposed to transfer from the commission to Oregon Youth Authority and be part of the juvenile crime plan. However, those dollars were taken out of the commission's budget in the governor's budget.
Okay. You want that money, don't you? Well, you want the money. Karen wants the money, right? Tell me about the money.
Karen Brazo, the Director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I support the basic underlying premise of the bill, which is to transfer some of these responsibilities to the commission, Criminal Justice Commission, to the Oregon Youth Authority. One of the amendments I'm suggesting would be to repeal those sections of the law regarding the court subsidy funds, because there is no money in the governor's recommended budget, that without the money, the transfer of the program to the Youth Authority has some attached responsibilities that simply make no sense and create a nonsensical burden on the Youth Authority without providing any additional assistance at all to the counties.
Makes sense. So Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, Donna would feel I was derelict if I failed to ask her the question, because we've been home together all morning. Are there any turf problems with this, Donna?
Any you can admit in public.
Senator Duncan, one of the other questions you asked is if I were to talk to other agencies,
yes,
what would they say? Karen, is there any turf problems with this?
Absolutely not.
I'm sorry. Ways and Means is pointing that to keep, but I kept asking that question.
Just the unfunded issue, that's the only thing that's really outstanding, right, is there's no money in the program. You got stuck with the program by the transfer in this bill.
Right.
You want that out.
That's right.
Okay.
I just do not have transfer of responsibilities without any funding.
Yeah. It looks to me like you're taking it,
right,
taking a hit here anyway.
My other proposed amendment would be to eliminate Section 2 in the bill, which, again, would transfer a requirement on the juvenile department directors to report on use of detention. Under current statute, they make that report to the Commission on Children and Families. Under this bill, they would make that report to the Oregon Youth Authority. I think that the juvenile justice information system makes that reporting obsolete. That information is readily available in JGIS, and all we need to do is run a report on detention use, and can do that any time, more frequently than annually if necessary. So it's kind of an obsolete, at this point, an obsolete.
Okay. Senator Harper?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably a Ways and Means question, but if the funding has been zeroed out and we leave the program with the commission and it's not funded there, who are we fooling? I mean, what's going on? Does anybody know?
Karen's right. I mean, it's a policy discussion. It's probably something we should talk to the Ways and Means Committee co-chair about, whether or not it's something that they have an interest in. If not, we'll just repeal the thing and move on.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think we should tell you that the agencies involved had agreed upon the concepts in this proposed legislation, long before there were discussions around the governor's recommended budget.
Yeah,
so you'd originally hoped the money would be there.
Right. Yes.
But what about the merits of the program that's not funded? Is it a good program?
Senator Minnis, the program is money that goes directly to the 36 juvenile departments, and those departments have been currently using the money to help fund juvenile probation officers, some shelter care, and some of the what I would call basic services in juvenile departments.
Okay, and that's going away. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Any other testimony? Or these? I think you're it. Okay. I think what we're going to do is ask to get some information from the Ways and Means folks and so on and so forth before we actually move on the bill or any amendments. Do you have the amendments, LC, drafted? No?
No.
No? Okay. That'll have to happen, too. All right. Thank you very much. I think I'm going to move back into public hearing on Senate Bill 230, try to wrap up the public hearing on that particular bill. Public hearing 230. Constance Hawes, we saw you yesterday.
Yes, I did a great job.
All right.
Yes, that's fine. No, that's just leave it like that, yeah.
Are we ready?
It's not as bad as it looks.
Oh, good.
First business is Dr. Sagelski, who addressed you, the Senate committee, last week. She prepared her documentation for you, and I'm going to give this to the aide to pass out to you when they can do that.
Thank
her
you.
Original letter is on top, and there's also a supplemental bibliography of these materials prepared by the Animal Legal Defense Fund. She's very sorry she couldn't be here today, and she said if you needed any more information, please don't hesitate to contact her through her office or her phone number.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. I'll try and sit where I can see everyone.
Okay, Constance, are you ready?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much for your patience. I'm Constance Hawes. I reside in Beaverton, and I'm very grateful for Senator Menas and for this committee to be hearing the rest of the testimony on Senate Bill 230. I've brought these pictures of Rose 2 to illustrate the problem with the current law in ORS 167. These pictures represent just a few of the 176 similar wounds inflicted by the abuser. In spite of the clear evidence of these many wounds and credible eyewitness testimony, the perpetrator was not prosecuted. I'm the person who initiated and sought the drafting of what has become Senate Bill 230 as a result of my inquiry and research into the circumstances contributing to the refusal of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office to prosecute the perpetrator of the April 17, 2000 abuse of the 6-year-old elephant Rose 2 at the Oregon Zoo. I found that there were problems with some of the sections in the animal abuse laws in Oregon, especially if the abuser did not cripple or kill the victimized animal. I found that the appeals court had set a standard of proof in human-to-human assault cases, which basically compelled the answer to the question, how much pain for how long a duration? Years ago, the animal abuse statutes had been tied to the laws about human assault through common definitions in ORS 161. Since human victims could answer that question and animals could not, a critically unfair and fundamentally flawed system was crystallized whereby animal abuse was difficult to prove or prosecute by that standard except in the most drastic cases. After talking to humane enforcement officers, animal control officers, and others on the front lines of dealing with Oregon's abused and neglected animals, I found that this flawed system had created a widespread problem and contributed to a gaping inconsistency of prosecution of animal abuse cases. I felt absolutely certain there must be a way to correct the weakness in the statutory law and eliminate this failure of the application of justice. I sought the assistance, expertise, advice, and feedback of many people, professionals, and agencies in the drafting of this legislation, which Senator Ryan Deckert unhesitatingly agreed to sponsor. And I must inform you that it was with the help of Charles Taylor in the Legislative Council and the Animal Legal Defense Fund attorneys that we were able to draft this legislation and work with many agencies, including the OVMA, Metro, the Zoo, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and many others who have endorsed this bill, to get a bill that would make everybody happy, so to speak, in terms of they could agree on a compromise position on the issues we wanted to address. At the beginning of my testimony, I referred to the facts in Rose 2's case, these exhibits representing a few of those wounds inflicted, and telling you of the professionals who were eyewitnesses to the 40-minute sequence of this event. The keepers responsible for Rose 2 had to clean and care for bleeding, seeping, and infected wounds for at least a month after the attack, and this is documented in the veterinary care records. And all of this was not enough still to prosecute the abuser under Oregon's current law. You might imagine how stunned I was to discover during my research ORS 166.076 sub 1b, which informs us that a person commits a misdemeanor A crime if he, quote, destroys, mutilates, removes, cuts, breaks, or injures any tree, shrub, or plant within a cemetery, a tomb, a monument, etc. These acts are treated as greater crimes than second-degree animal abuse, which is classified only as a Class B misdemeanor. Under current Oregon law, had Rose II been a shrub in a cemetery, she would have had more and better justice. As did the victim of a beer can tossed to the face, who said that it hurt, caused redness, swelling, and bruising, which was enough to qualify under that definition of physical injury in ORS 161 for that complainant to have his day in court. I found this case cited in the ORS annotations, and it was the basis of my inquiry with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office to get to the bottom of why someone with a bruised and swelling face could qualify for an assault trial, and the elephant with 176 stab wounds could not. Senate Bill 230 will define physical injury, physical trauma, serious physical injury, and aggravated abuse in a manner that will in fact have relevance to the abused animals we are trying to protect and whom reasonable people seek fair applications of justice for. Senate Bill 230 will give district attorneys better tools to successfully prosecute animal abuse offenses, and Senate Bill 230 will give law enforcement more tools to intervene on behalf of at-risk animals. Senate Bill 230 will also make it more certain that certain repeat violent offenders receive sentences more commensurate with their behavior, thus affording society greater protection in at least two ways. These offenders will be off the streets for a somewhat longer period of time, and they will be made to face, at least if not understand, that animal abuse crimes are serious crimes and not just horseplay. The personality type which begins a criminal career tormenting cats and ends that career as a child molester, rapist, or serial killer will be confronted at an earlier stage when second-degree abuse can be prosecuted in this state. Hopefully, society will reap a benefit from this form of earlier intervention and eventually have fewer Kit Kinkles over whom to grieve. I respectfully ask and urge the Senate Judiciary Committee to amend Senate Bill 230 as needed to achieve the best bill possible in this session, to send it on with a due pass recommendation to the full Oregon Senate, and I thank you very much for your patience and your attention to this matter. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Constance. Any questions? Senator Harper?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who's attachment C, this existing, I guess, proposed? Is that ours or?
Mr. Chair and members, I think that's from Stefan Otto, and they created that with some
is
of the
Is that
amendments.
The section by section description?
Yes.
That was prepared by Stefan Otto of the Animal Legal Defense Fund, a section-by-section description of the bill, as well as the boxed form that basically compares current law to the law as it would be under the amended Senate Bill 230. I've highlighted the areas on that boxed version where there are differences between current law and the proposed changes of Senate Bill 230.
Well, let me just, the question then, if I could, is reading current law, to me, is not confusing that this individual should have been prosecuted. Can you give me a little background?
The background is that the appellate court has set a standard that there must be testimony from the victim or someone who in fact can expertly testify as to the fact of how long a pain lasted and how intense it was. The problem with prosecuting animal abuse cases when the animal is not crippled or dead is that the animal can't, literally, the DA that I talked to who was responsible for the internal memo that made this decision at the Multnomah County DA said, the animal can't get on the stand and testify. That is the problem. And expert witnesses cannot also say for sure how long did that elephant suffer, how much pain. And that's why they didn't prosecute this case. And in fact, as I did continue my investigation with humane officers and Oregon animal control officers throughout the state, I found this to be a widespread problem. Some district attorneys might have prosecuted this. We heard from a judge yesterday on 227 who was speaking of this same problem, the discretionary limits that are there because the law isn't specific enough. And some other district attorney might have prosecuted this under this condition of the elephant. But in fact, the appellate court standard requiring the answers to those questions is the problem, and those come from the tie-in to the definition of physical injury in 167 now, which is based on the definition 161, the assault, human assault statutes. Does that help answer that question, what the difference is?
Yeah.
Senator Harper?
Senator, you have a letter from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office kind of citing the Higgins case. I guess it's an authority in 2000. Regarding the pure sensory issue, but I think Constance has a point. It kind of depends on which DA you get and which judge you get in terms of how they want to apply it.
And I guess Could you point out to me exactly where your suggested changes will fix this problem?
Right. In the Senate bill itself, those are sections...
Mr. Chair,
Section 6, sub 6, sub 7, and then in the Section 9, sub 1 or 2A and B, for the redefining malicious and tortures, so they will have relevance to animal abuse. Tortures is not defined in ORS anywhere, and they have a problem with that in human cases as well, and they suggested that we come to an agreement about what that would mean in animal abuse cases, and Stefan worked with the District Attorneys, Oregon District Attorneys Association, to come up with a definition that was suitable for this particular purpose in that section. And then the section on serious physical injury is probably right after Section 6.
Okay, thank you.
Does that help?
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator.
All right. Constance, thank you very much. That's any additional questions?
Okay.
And we're going to adjourn, by the way, at 2:30, so I want to try to move through the testimony if I can. Lieutenant Randy Cogan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lieutenant Randy Covey. I'm employed by the Oregon Humane Society and here representing that organization. Senate Bill 230 addresses the need for clarification of Oregon revised statutes pertaining to animal welfare crimes. In addition, Senate Bill 230 provides for a broader range of options when considering the severity of said crimes and would allow enforcement officers to more accurately identify the nature of the crime committed. As a law enforcement officer commissioned specifically to enforce the animal welfare laws of the state of Oregon, my primary responsibility is to investigate alleged crimes under the laws addressed by Senate Bill 230. The changes proposed by this bill will make these laws more animal-specific and eliminate any ambiguity as to what constitutes abuse and or neglect of an animal by defining terms such as physical injury, serious physical injury, and physical trauma. In previous testimony heard last week by this committee, the removal of language that requires obtaining a search warrant under these laws was questioned. I would submit to this committee that the replacement language, any manner authorized by law, includes, in fact requires, the presence of probable cause to act under exigent circumstances or to obtain a search warrant. Senate Bill 230 also recognizes the connection between animal abuse and human abuse and allows for a more serious charge if the person committing the offense has previously been twice convicted under any animal abuse laws or any domestic violence laws or offenses committed against a minor child. I believe this committee has also heard testimony in the past relating to those issues. The Oregon Humane Society investigates over 1,000 allegations of animal abuse and neglect every year. Although many of these cases are resolved through education and not through prosecution, strengthening and clarifying the applicable statutes will allow law enforcement officers and district attorneys across the state to address those cases where prosecution is clearly the appropriate recourse. Identification, investigation, intervention, and prosecution of animal welfare crimes can prevent future crimes against humans. Senate Bill 230 recognizes this connection and provides the tools and clarification necessary to help ensure a safer, more progressive, and ultimately better society in which to live. On behalf of the Oregon Humane Society and specifically the Law Enforcement Division, I urge you to support Senate Bill 230 and work diligently to ensure that it becomes law. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Any questions? All right. Thank you for submitting your statement in writing to Senator Duncan.
I'm just curious, Mr. Chair, about the Law Enforcement Division of the Humane Society. I'm not quite sure how that how that works. Is that appropriate question to ask at this point?
You bet.
I'm just curious. The Humane Society is a private organization, right?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, I appreciate the question.
Yeah, I just didn't know anything about it. I just was curious.
The Oregon Humane Society is, in fact, a private organization. The governor, under the Oregon Revised Statute, has the authority to appoint what's technically known as special agents anytime that the governor feels that the laws of the state are being violated, and regular law enforcement agencies may not have the resources, the training, or experience to address, investigate, and prosecute those laws. That's the authority that the Oregon Humane Society Law Enforcement Division operates under.
I see. Okay. I just wasn't aware of that part of it. Okay. How many officers are there assigned?
Unfortunately, only two, Mr. Senator Duncan.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Sorry to take your time. But I just...
Lori Lowndes. You got big cursive writing.
Haunted me my whole life. Chair Minnis and committee members, my name is Lori Lown, and I am the Northwest Outreach Coordinator for a national nonprofit organization in defense of animals. I am here to speak about Senate Bill 230, not only as an employee of an animal rights group, but as a concerned citizen. I can cite at least five different occurrences of animal abuse in the past few months, and that is one of the reasons why I'm here today to testify. All of these cases were a direct result of malicious intent by humans to torture and or kill defenseless animals. We have already seen the physical wounds against Rose 2 at the hands of her caretaker. When we think of a caretaker, we do not envision that an individual with this title could inflict 176 puncture wounds, whether the assault be to humans or non-humans. Yet it happened at our own Oregon Zoo to a baby elephant, and the caretaker was unable to be prosecuted under our current law. We all know of another case, the case of Purr the kitten that was doused with gasoline by two teenage boys and set on fire. This kitten suffered for 3 weeks before she finally succumbed to death. In October, there was an incident at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos County. A raccoon was lured with food into a dorm room and shot with BB pellets, kicked and beaten to death with a stick. Afterwards, the animal's tail was found hanging from the perpetrator's dorm room door. Then there was a disturbing story about a pet pygmy goat that was tortured and killed in December by five individuals, four adult men and one juvenile. This goat was stolen. His mouth was bound with duct tape. His eyes were shot with pellets, and firecrackers were inserted into the goat's anus, and the explosion of these caused the animal's very painful death. Just recently, four puppies were placed in a plastic garbage bag and thrown from a moving vehicle. Luckily, a passerby saw something move in the bag and pulled it out of the street, discovering these five-week-old puppies. All of the puppies survived but were injured, one severely. The perpetrator of this horrific deed is unknown. Then there was the case of the unlucky dog who picked up a tennis ball on his walk only to have it explode in his mouth and killing him. The recipient could have been a child. The point being that people who commit such acts of violence are indiscriminate in whom their victim may be, whether humans or non-humans. Working for In Defense of Animals, I have seen it all and I have heard it all. There are never-ending stories of abuse, neglect, and abandonment. To quote Abraham Lincoln, "I am in favor of animal rights as well as human rights. It is the way of a whole human being." I encourage you, Chair Minnis and committee members, to please vote yes on Senate Bill 230. The laws need to make it clear to offenders that abuse to any living creature will not be tolerated in our state. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Any questions?
Questions?
I don't sense any.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Doug Riggs. Metro, I'm trying to figure out, what does Metro have to do? Oh, I guess Zoo, right?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Riggs. I work for PacWest Communications, and we are the lobbyist on record for Metro. Mr. Chairman, your question is a good one. Many people do not know that Metro does more than just do land use planning, transportation planning, expo, the convention center, and also the zoo. And as a result, the council has asked me to come and read into the record testimony on this issue. I will say that we feel this is a very important issue. It's something that has been one of our top priorities over the last several months, and we're very pleased that Senator Deckard and the coalition of people that we have behind us have been working diligently on this issue. I'll take less than 2 minutes because I know your time is of the essence at this point. As the government responsible for the Oregon Zoo, Metro has an ethical, humanitarian, and legal obligation to protect more than 1,000 animals, ranging from butterflies to elephants. Metro takes that obligation very seriously. Tragically, last spring, one of our employees abused a juvenile elephant, Rose Two, by beating her for more than 30 minutes with an iron rod. Twice, the employee hooked her and dragged her to her knees, screaming. Other Metro employees intervened at great risk their own safety. The elephant suffered more than 170 cuts to her hide, but fortunately, she was not injured more seriously and has now recovered physically fully. The zoo director at Metro immediately suspended and, after an internal investigation, fired the abusive employee. After the matter was reported to the police, and as the testimonies indicated, all of us discovered a flaw in the underlying statute that governs prosecution of these types of cases. Animal abuse in the second degree requires proof of physical injury, a term which is borrowed from the human assault statutes. What makes sense in the context of a human assault victim who can testify, unfortunately, doesn't make sense for an animal who can't. The question in this case was whether the elephant suffered enough pain to qualify her for a physical injury statute. The DA's attorney, district attorney's office, concluded that without expert testimony about how much the elephant had suffered, they would not be able to file a charge. Since then, the authorities and a variety of interested citizens have spent considerable time consulting with experts throughout the country to try to arrive at a common-sense solution to this issue. And we're pleased the result has been SB 230, which we strongly support and would urge your strong consideration of. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Riggs. Appreciate it. Questions? No questions. Thank you. Appreciate it. Ingrid Swenson.
Good afternoon, Chair Minister and members of the committee. We have a number of concerns with this measure. However, we are also aware that the matter is on for public hearing today, and we understand that the sponsor of the bill is willing to look at some of the issues that we have as well as others, and we would like to work with him on that. And so to save your time and everyone's, I'll withhold my comments for today.
All right. Thank you, Ingrid. Appreciate that. To Tom Buchholz and Glenn Stonebrink. Glenn, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I've given testimony from former Representative Jim Welch, who's now representing the Oregon Farm Family Association. I do not have a written testimony, but I do want to quickly, and I know you want to move. Our concerns with this bill, as you notice, the amendments address ORS 167.322, and in that particular section, it does not give an exemption to good animal husbandry. So that's our first concern. On page 1, line 9, it allows for lay testimony as to problems. And a very quick story, when I was ranching in Lalau County, the county road went right through our farm operation. Our shop was right there, and the cattle were very close by. We had someone drop by one day, it was sightseeing, and alerted us to the fact that we had a cow who was suffering quite severely. I asked him where it was. He said, it's just right over the hill, right by your gate. And I said, is she in real bad pain? And he said, yes, she's in terrible pain. And I said, was she bawling? And yes, she was bawling. And I was funning him because this was a cow that was calving. And I asked him if when he was parked there, did the cow get up and move? He said yes, because he parked quite close to her. She was close to the road. In the process of calving, we don't bother them. We know about how long it takes to have a normal birth. And we leave them alone. We check on them from time to time from a distance so we don't disturb them. I use this as an example because layperson don't often know what really happens on the ranch and what we do need to do with animals. Then there is on the number of places where the wording is taken out of the bill that deals with intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. That's on page 3, lines 31 and lines 37. Again, I believe that when people write bills to become laws, they do so with a purpose, not only with the words they put in, but the words they take out. And I read that as that the way it was written, the way the law is now, that if you do this on purpose, if you take this out, it wouldn't have that meaning if you just cause an injury. So if you accidentally cause an injury, you would still be liable under this bill. The it's on page 4, line 42, and page 5, line 6. Again, it's back to the probable cause. I think that when someone takes the words out of this that require probable cause before the end of the premises, there's a meaning behind that. And even though it says the peace officer may, I'm on page 5, line 4, a peace officer may in any manner authorized by law. But they took out the words probable cause. Those words came from our U.S. Constitution to start with, that you had to have that search warrant. And then it goes on to say, enter premises where animal is or is believed to be. So that ties back to the layperson's testimony. If you just believe that there might be something, that might be good enough to come onto your premises. The page 4, line 19, classify coercing of an animal as torture. And when I looked up the word coerce in Webster's, it says compel an act. And I have never been able to talk my cattle to go down the chute. I've tried, and I've even cursed, and that didn't do any good. It would prohibit, a prodding would be considered physical trauma. If you put them in a squeeze chute or use a lariat, this could be construed as trauma. And we also have concerns on page 5, line 4, which deals with just the idea of peace officers and the peace officers who are employed, and this was talked about earlier, who are employed by a private organization.
I'm sure I do.
That's all I have for now, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. We would strongly urge you to vote no on this bill.
Okay, questions? Any?
And Mr. Chairman, if there's no questions, you have another meeting.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Tom Buchholz. I spoke last week, but I didn't do a very good job, I don't think, so I'm here to try again. So my intent for the past two legislatures was to bring up the level of training for animal control officers so they could enforce these laws that you're trying to pass now. As it is now, your Class C felonies and stuff can only be investigated by police officers, and most of them already think their plates are too full. So I have a letter from the school written to me May 14th, 1999, Diane Middle, the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, DPSST, asked that I respond to concerns you voiced in your letter April 27, 1999. And this is written by Leonard Williamson, then the Legal Services Coordinator for the school. It says, the criminal procedure class includes lectures and exercises covering the concepts of accident, circumstances, and probable cause. It is important that students master these concepts since they must be applied to almost all areas of law, criminal law that officers are faced on with a daily basis. Additionally, recruits learn the necessary elements of a search warrant and the process necessary to make application for one. I'm skipping a little bit here. It says, basic recruits are provided with a strong foundation upon which they may draw to serve challenges they meet upon leaving DPSST. However, not all situations that the officers may encounter can be covered in the classroom setting. This is why we focus on providing basic recruits with tools necessary to provide problems in the field. Finally, current criminal law curriculum is designed to familiarize recruits with the Oregon Criminal Code. Recruits are frequently required to find answers by digging into the Oregon Criminal Code and reading the law. This provides recruits with a better foundation upon which to draw. Okay. As I look at this amendment here again, I'm looking at, which one is it? One we were just looking at, actually. It's ORS 167.345, which is, I guess, on page 4, 5, line 4. I'm looking at this thing they handed out the other day that had the comparison. Well, once you compare these two laws, you'll see that they took out more than just probable cause and search warrant. They took out the word also excellent circumstance. So you have excellent circumstance, probable cause, and excellent circumstances, probable cause, and search warrant taken out of them. Well, I guess the question I have to ask is, what's the intent to removing? Why is there a need to move these? These were put into law in 1995 because of Vicki Kittles. Before, when I was convicted, they had no problem convicting me in court. They were just required to have a search warrant. In 1995, they cleared up the law by saying that if there's excellent circumstances, the officer could come on the property and provide care for the animal. If there's probable cause, he could get a search warrant. Even with these words missing, excellent circumstances, probable cause, and search warrant, even if they're missing, these words are written on the foundation of the United States and Oregon Constitution. So I'm part of this bill I like, part of this bill I don't like. So that's where I'm at. I think that the 167.347 is written fine, and it should be left as it alone. I don't see where that would help them convict any animal abuse cases. You know, people that own animals have rights also. So thank you very much.
All right, Tom. Thank you so much. Appreciate your testimony, and I've lost my witness list. There we go. Paige Clarkson, Oregon District Attorney's Association. There are.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, my name is Paige Clarkson. I am representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association here this afternoon. As we were listening to the testimony, Gina Williamson Skinner, also a deputy district attorney in Marion County, as I am, representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association. Both of us, as we're sitting back there, heard some issues that maybe we could address together. Some of us have, she has better knowledge of some things, and I have better knowledge of some things, so we both came up together. Essentially, the broad overview of ODAA's position on this bill is obviously that we support it. I don't think there's anybody in this room who would say that animal neglect or abuse is a good thing. So if we could obviously all agree that from a policy standpoint, this bill has good intentions and good policies behind it. Specifically, we wanted to come to address and maybe help you answer some questions about details in the language specifically and how that assists us. It seems like that's kind of where the questioning is leading. And that maybe we can help you answer some of those issues. Specifically, it sounds like the injury, the change in that language has been an issue. We are of the opinion that changing the language to include physical trauma is a good objective and effective objective way to assess physical injury. When we're dealing with humans, it's simply a different standard. And when, as prosecutors, when we're using language that is being applied to humans in one way, and then we're trying to apply it to animals in another, it affects our way and our ability to prove a case. We obviously work here in Marion County, can't speak to the Rose 2 issues, but we have other examples of cases where we've couldn't prove a crime because we couldn't establish physical injury under the way that it reads.
Now, can I ask you a question? That seems to be one of the central issues here.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, procedures and laws that exist would be functional but for that definition of physical injury or some other strategy. Is that accurate?
Chairman, maybe I can answer that question. I know that previously, and I'm Gina Skinner from the District Attorney's, Oregon District Attorney Association. I'm a deputy district attorney, and we were talking about, and last time I was here, once again, I didn't bring everything I wish I had so that I could answer all of your questions fully, but we were discussing the case at State v. Higgins. That's the most recent case from the Oregon Court of Appeals that discussed and defined and redefined the issue of physical injury. I prosecute mostly domestic violence cases. I've done several animal cases also, and that is an area of the law that is covered in both of those. And that case, in my opinion, it doesn't make it better or worse, it just sort of redefined it more. To get physical injury under the law, you have to show that either you have an impairment of your physical condition or substantial pain. So you don't have to have both. And what that case basically says, from my memory since I don't have it with me, is that serious physical injury requires protracted pain. And so it says it has to be less than protracted pain. There's also a case that talks about how it's not fleeting pain. So you can have pain that lasts a short period of time. Again, fleeting is not defined either, but it has to be more than fleeting, less than protracted. The problem that we have with just talking about that part of the definition, which is substantial pain, is for animals, it's very difficult to establish pain because obviously they can't talk, they can't verbalize, and they may, sometimes you might have a situation where they cry out, but animals, from I think everyone's common sense and personal experience, have a high tolerance of pain. You'll see your cat come in from a fight and they'll be bleeding from all over the place and they're walking around like nothing's wrong, but they're clearly, you would think they would be in pain. If it was you, you'd be in pain, but you don't know. And one of the cases we were talking about this afternoon before we came over here was a case in our office where a dog was shot with a BB gun and it was lodged in its body. It didn't cry out in pain or any way that a human could establish that there was pain, yet they had to take it to the hospital, to the animal hospital to have surgery. It was removed and then it survived afterwards and went around like it was fine. And in trial, we were unable to establish that was physical injury because I couldn't show, it wasn't my case, but the deputy couldn't show that there was pain under the definition of substantial pain. The other side of the definition of physical injury is impairment of physical condition. So there you have to show that in some way your condition is impaired. Now, in people, we do this by showing that that you have somebody that's been punched, and so they've got a black eye 3 days later, or they've got a cut lip that impairs their ability to eat properly, or they've got bruising on their arms or their legs, or in some function of their body is not working the way it's supposed to work. And again, with animals, they will often get hurt, but still, I mean, there are animals that have three legs that walk around just fine, and they don't seem to be impaired in the way that humans are impaired, or we can identify that, well, when I go to work, I need to lift boxes. I can't lift boxes the way I regularly do. I'm a child. I have small children at home, and I can't lift them because my arms hurt from, that there's something that you can identify. And with animals, it's so difficult to do that. And so I think our basic premise is with the way it's been defined, and State v. Higgins just goes through that and lists several situations where there's a combination of either, you only have to have one or the other, but most cases you have some pain and some physical manifestation of that pain that is in a bump, a lump, a bruise, and it even says specifically in that case that scratches alone may be enough to be physical injury under the circumstances if they're in conjunction with something that you can identify that's impaired your physical condition or that you have some level of pain, but it talks about cases where people have been hurt but they didn't know they were hurt until someone says, hey, you've got blood running down your face. Did you know that? They're like, oh, no, I didn't. That it doesn't hurt right now. And it didn't really impair them in any way. Those are the cases they say are not physical injury. And unfortunately, the way animals often manifest their injury is it falls into that category where we can see there's something wrong with it, but without being able to speak to the animal, you don't get it. And the way they redefine it here.
I sense you're talking yourself right into a work group.
Right into it.
Oh.
The way they redefine it here is that there's objective words that we use, you know, that it's like, you know, if it is, I'd have to look at the bill, but it is a lump, it is a bump, it is a scratch, you know, then it's like, aha, that is what it is.
Something you want to say? No?
I just, you know, anybody listening to the man on the street listening to this over the radio must think we're nuts. An open stab wound is not an injury. So when you have your work group, would you please define an open stab wound as to be an injury? Goodness gracious.
Well, I think part of the issue is just the ability to provide some proof, to quantify that in a courtroom where people who may not have any familiarity with the subject matter would say, yes, indeed, that should be a crime. And with people, they can come in and say, yes, this person hit me in the face, and yes, it hurt, and here are the pictures or whatever, or my friend can demonstrate or show that I had a black eye, some testimony. But animals obviously cannot do that. And just the mere, you know, when it gets the elephants, to me, it's like 170 slash wounds or scratches would be, in my opinion, inconsistent with what one might consider normal treatment for an animal of that nature. So that's why we need some certified smart people dealing with all of those legal provisions and stuff to try to give us some standard by which prosecutors could say, look, this animal was not treated in a manner that would be normal under the circumstances, so that we don't get into the animal husbandry issue and farming and that, you know, so we're not touching on those kind of things, because we slaughter cows to eat them, and I certainly wouldn't want that to become animal abuse, because I like cheeseburgers.
Right. And Chairman, what I would add too is when we're dealing with humans and we're proving physical injury with humans, sometimes we don't have victims, and Ms. Skinner can certainly tell you that we prosecute dozens and hundreds of domestic violence cases every year without the victim, because they're simply not cooperative at the point that we go to trial. So I don't want to mislead anyone to think that we can only prove these physical injury cases when we have a victim. That isn't the case. But in those cases, what you can do is you can draw on everybody's collective common sense and experience as human beings and say, you know, look at this gash on her head. We have a picture of it. This hurt her. We know it hurt her. We don't have the correlation with animals. And so what this does is this allows us to say, objectively, this would be injury.
I think we can get there under the totality of the circumstances type thing, justification. What was your justification? Because oftentimes there's injury that's inflicted on a child for disciplinary purposes, which is okay under the law. But if it's outside of that context, then it becomes potentially a criminal act. So.
And Chairman, if I also add that I do think that there are provisions in this bill that do allow for instance, the definition of physical trauma specifically says that it doesn't include minor injuries consistent with an accident or normal handling technique. So it wouldn't be something that it was a husbandry situation or it just accidentally happened. You know, everybody's accidentally kicked their dog as you're running through the, you know, as he's running past you through the house and you trip over him. That isn't something. Have you not done that? I'm just saying there are accidents that occur, and there's certainly provisions in this bill that deal with that, and it's something that I think as prosecutors we could probably work with.
All right, thank you. We're gonna do a work group of some sort, I think, on this thing and set it off. The certified smart people to come up with something that makes sense.
And I'm sorry, I don't know, but I didn't know if you wanted to hear anything about that last section that was talked about. No,
okay.
about the 24-hour change. So no, okay.
No, we'll make this thing better. Hopefully, and if it gets better, it'll come back. If it doesn't get any better, probably won't come back.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Dave Barrows. Always a pleasure to have Mr. Barrows. You're almost as good as Ozzie Rose in terms of witnesses to beat up on. Just kidding.
Thank you for that compliment, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Barrows. I represent the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. We are here to support this bill with the inclusion of the -1 and the -3 amendments. I won't add anything further, Mr. Chairman. There are certified, it'll be smart people who can work on this. We will be watching with interest because we do think this is an important step forward. But the bill does need changes. We think -1 and -3 get us there. There may be other issues that others have to
do. -1 and -2 or -1 and -3?
-1 and -3. We do not support -2.
Not support -2?
No, sir.
Any questions, Mr. Burrows?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's your opportunity. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
I'm trying to figure out why you don't support the dash twos.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, in section four, this is the kind of, this is the repeat offender section, and if somebody has livestock, a cow or a donkey or something, and repeatedly abuses it, it should lose, that individual should not escape just simply because it's livestock versus a domestic animal. There is in here sufficient, we think, sufficient protection for people who are in the business. Down in subsection three, Senator Beyer, for people that are in the business, that they don't have to, they don't have to go through the hoops in one and two. But if I own a mule and I abuse it all the time, and I'm convicted for abusing it all the time, I shouldn't be able to walk, skate, just simply because it's a mule as opposed to a dog. So that's why I don't think just removing livestock out of that section totally is appropriate. People that are in the business are protected. People who just keep one or two head aren't protected any more than people that have domestic animals and repeatedly offend.
In subsection three, you mentioned that exempts people who are legitimately in the business?
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, that's my understanding, yes.
Okay, I'm just, as I'm reading through subsection three, and I'm talking about line 13 and 14 now, and paraphrase, if the person has the licenses required for the sale or resale, or drives at least 25% of the person's annual gross income from the sale or resale, what licenses do cattlemen have?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, I can't answer that question. I'm sorry, I don't know.
Okay,
I assume they have some kind of license or some kind of certification from the Department of Agriculture, but there are people here who probably can answer that question. I can't, Senator.
Well, owning cows myself, I don't have a license to own them.
Well.
Yes, where's that sheriff?
But I'm sure, Senator Beyer, you treat them humanely, so it's not an issue.
Where is that guy in a brown shirt?
I don't know the answer to that.
Under this bill, it would be an issue. This bill has many, many things in it that, as Glenn Stonebrink testified to, that many common practices in livestock handling would be illegal under this bill.
But I would say, Mr. Chairman, if I may, Senator Beyer, some of the issues that he raised are addressed in the amendments. I'm not saying that the amendments make him well, but they a number of them, redefinition of torture, and there's a number of other things in here in the dash one and dash three amendments that speak to a number of the issues that Mr. Stonebrink brought before the committee. I'm not trying to suggest that fixes all of his problems, because that he has to say that, but we couldn't support the bill without the dash one and dash three for some of the same reasons that he brought forward.
Well, I think we're going towards the right objective. I mean, somebody once said that the word abuse comes from two words, abnormal and use, abnormal use. So, I mean, we really don't want to get into the area where you've got people who are literally in the business where they have, and I don't know if it's legal to have cows or not. I mean,
I do.
Yeah, without a license or something.
It's completely legal.
So if you've got those and you're doing whatever you do with cows on a normal basis, I don't think the bill is supposed to try to deal with that. It's supposed to be dealing with the abnormal use of or the beating and abuse of those animals. Ma'am.
Interrupt you. Thank you. Are you representing the veterinarians here? I missed your...
Yes, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. It's the Association of Veterinarians in the state.
I wanted to ask if you... Because as I was listening and reading through this, I wanted to just ask your opinion on whether this bill adequately... protects perhaps well-meaning but maybe also misguided people who take extraordinary measures to save an animal that might involve pain, that perhaps a reasonable person might say, well, you should just put that animal to sleep. In my circumstance, it was a little kitten that lost its leg, and the veterinarian had no experience because everyone else in that circumstance just euthanized the kitten and made the decision to save the kitten, which involved a lot of pain over a period of time. The cat's doing fine now, but whether, in your opinion, and maybe just to have them look at it in this light for, you know, to save an animal, there might be a period where they might go through severe pain that perhaps another, you know, another decision could be to just simply euthanize the animal, avoid the pain, that type of thing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, those are decisions that are made often every day by veterinarians and the owners of the animals. And decisions, both parties, I think, have to arrive at a joint decision. And this bill would not impair that ability of the owner to say, okay, I agree with you, the best thing to do is euthanize it, or let's do everything we can to save it, even though it involves pain. I mean, we all go through that in surgery and recovery from surgery. So this doesn't impact that in a negative way.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to bring that on the record.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You, appreciate it. Kelly Peterson.
Chair Minnis and members of the committee, my name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm with the Humane Society of the United States, and we have about 73,000 members and constituents in Oregon. And although all the testimony, I feel like I should repeat it all again and again, but I will save you and not, because my testimony is pretty much the same. We do support Senate Bill 230, and you know, I could list study after study that shows the links between, you know, animal abuse and human violence, but I'll just leave it at that and be on the record. So thank you very much. And you know, I didn't properly thank Chair Minnis and Senator Peter Courtney for introducing Senate Bill 227. It's really important, and both bills are very meaningful and will affect the lives of a lot of animals. So thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Any questions? None? Thank you very much. Thanks. Appreciate it. That concludes the public testimony. Is there anybody out here who feels compelled to testify who hasn't had a chance to testify? All right. We're going to close the public hearing on that Senate Bill 230. And I'm going to ask my competent counsel here to organize a work group on this bill to include Glenn Stonebrink from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Senator Courtney, going back in a little time warp here. Paige Clarkson or Gina Skinner, any of those two, we might want to choose to do that. And I'd like to ask Senator Harper to participate.
You'll be with me. It's you and me, buddy.
That's what I was worried about.
Anybody else up there I left out that absolutely feels compelled to be involved? Oh, that's right. Ingrid. She did help. All right. We'll see what kind of work product comes out of that. And we'll consult with the sponsors. We're not going to include you in the work group per se, but I want to have them consult with you as it progresses with that. Okay. All right. Thank you. And now we're going to move on to which one is it? Let's see.
Thank you.
Yeah, I got that.
No, I mean, you know, we're talking about, I bring the big help lady came up, and here's the chair, and you have...
Okay, who's my witness on...
My heart's hurt.
Bonnie, is that you?
Skip the ring. Skip the ring. Bless the cheese. Stop for a second.
Bonnie, just give us this a second. We've got to get control of the committee.
I have no idea yet what's going on. I have no idea. I just... You're slow. Everybody heard it except Minnesota.
We'll tell you later.
I think you ought to keep him hanging for a while.
Was he hanging for a while?
I was disappointed we didn't get you.
Yeah, everybody heard
it. It was just...
You guys have the unfortunate experience of following days worth of animal testimony. Please forgive us if our attention is not...
Well, we're with you.
Did I do something funny or stupid? Which was it?
No, we're talking about...
All right. Connie, go for it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher, Director of Crime Victims Assistance with the Department of Justice. I'm here once again to request a small statutory change related to the administration of the Crime Victims Compensation Program. As you'll recall, this is a program whose goal is to ease the financial losses that victims of crime incur as a direct result of their victimization. It operates by reimbursing victims for out-of-pocket expenses related to their recovery. And the expenses that are covered include things such as medical, dental costs, hospital costs, counseling expenses, transportation to treatment. Those are some of the examples of benefits that crime victims receive. By statute, accepted claims remain open for 3 years or until the statutory limit is reached in terms of financial benefits, whichever comes first. In most cases, 3 years is an adequate length of time for victims to have addressed the services that they need and for our program to adequately reimburse them for the out-of-pocket expenses. Okay. However, there are on occasion cases where the injuries to the victim are such that the costs and the care that that victim needs must extend beyond a 3-year period of time. An example of this might be an incident that happened down in Eugene. There were 4 co-eds from University of Oregon who were hit broadside by a drunk driver, and one of the victims incurred serious injury to a number of limbs. And in an effort to save her leg, extensive surgery was going to have to be undertaken over a period of years. This victim did have insurance, but the insurance was not going to cover the total cost of the surgeries that were needed for this victim. And unfortunately, with our current statutory limitation of 3 years, we would not be able to reimburse this victim for the out-of-pocket costs that she was going to have to spend for the surgeries that went on from year to year. Senate Bill 352 asks that Crime Victims Compensation Program be provided with the authority to draft administrative rules that would define catastrophic injuries and also allow the department to extend the length of benefit eligibility for victims with such injuries. It will not increase the maximum allowable benefit. We would continue to retain the statutory limits on each of the benefits that's currently present. While there are not a large number of victims that would be eligible for the extended benefit period, for those who are, removal of this administrative barrier to benefits for which the victim would otherwise be entitled will mean a great deal. Thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Connie.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Minnis, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Arwin Bird, and I represent survivors advocating for an effective system. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 352. Our organization firmly supports a survivor's right to compensation. This bill would provide a needed extension of that right. I can testify from personal experience that the costs of catastrophic injury go far beyond 3, 5, or 8 years post-injury. I was diagnosed with osteoporosis 5 years after my injury, a direct result of paralysis by a drunk driver. This diagnosis requires expensive medication and physical therapy. I use this example to illustrate the arbitrary nature of the current limitation. As survivors, we do not always realize the extent of the injury within 1, 3, or 10 years, or if we do, the rehabilitation required may exceed 3 years post-injury. The state of Oregon should also recognize this fact with regards to the compensation it provides to survivors of catastrophic injury. Oregon statute clearly defines monetary compensation for damages. This bill does not affect those limitations. Senate Bill 352 would simply extend the period of time compensation applies in some of the most needed circumstances. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Bird.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Soto. I'm with the Lincoln County Victims Assistance Program, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 352. And first of all, I must apologize. When I wrote my written testimony, I was interpreting the term of catastrophic injury as I would interpret it and not as the statute would interpret it. So everything I was going to talk about would not really apply. But I do have one particular instance that we had seen in Lincoln County. About 4.5 years ago, we had a woman who was shot by her then-boyfriend as she was trying to leave. And she was shot through the jaw. It ricocheted off of her spinal cord and has since been a quadriplegic. In being a quadriplegic, she's at risk for a variety of different diseases, and the common cold could send her to death. But included with that is she requires physical therapy daily for the rest of her life, and she's only 38 years old. So this would certainly take her, if she were to not die from pneumonia, this would certainly take her beyond the 3-year limit. So I ask that you support Senate Bill 352.
Okay. Any questions? Is everybody on the committee familiar with the Crime Victims Assistance Program and where the money comes from?
Yes. Yeah, I have a question for Arvin, if I could. Arvin?
Yes.
I've heard you testify before and talking about some of the expenditures you have ongoing. Through the program, through the crime assistance, do you get any assistance on that at all, or are you on your own now?
Chair, Senator Duncan, I quickly reached the limitations of the amount that I was able to recover from the state, so I'm not currently eligible for compensation.
Because I know you're
those are covered. Sure. They're covered by insurance.
Well, they are covered.
Thank you for remembering.
Yeah, I do remember the discussion.
Okay, good. We'll. I don't think there's no one else signed up, so this is scheduled for a public hearing only and not a work session. So we'll schedule a work session for Monday, unless there's some.
Let's go into a conceptual work session.
Can't do it. 24-hour notice. We can do it towards the end of the session, however, when we go to the 1 hour.
Mr. Chair, I will be gone on Monday. I'd just like to get on the record that I would be very supportive of this bill, though.
I'll
be here to vote for it.
Mr. Is it Soto?
Soto, yes.
Soto, you had mentioned a definition of catastrophic injuries in the statute. There isn't one for this statute, correct? I mean, it's going to be defined by rules. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Just want to make sure I wasn't missing one.
Well, I apologize. I had my own interpretation as I define it as a victim's assistance person who advocates for victims in working with them. Even what I was prepared to speak about was counseling and how counseling could extend over a long period of time, especially if somebody has some post-traumatic stress disorder or those types of things. But it's not spelled out that way. At least yet, we hope to get there.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much
for
your testimony. I appreciate it. We close the public hearing. Senate Bill 352 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 346.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee. My name is Shelley McIntyre. I am an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, and they asked me to stand in and express the department's support for this bill.
Get the short straw?
Excuse me?
Get the short straw?
The short straw, yes, cool. All the way from Portland, too. I told them I'd only do it if they'd give me a popsicle, because that's what I do for my six-year-old when she has to go to the dentist. And so I'm waiting to see if they're out in the hall with my popsicle.
It's going to be worth more than a popsicle.
What this bill does is provide a remedy and by way of injunctive relief for public servants, which is defined, the term is referred to existing statutory definition, for public servants who are facing, who are harassed, menaced, intimidated, et cetera, and are unable to perform their jobs. And I have a few examples that I can just run through quickly. Think about being an enforcement person for an agency out in Eastern Oregon, and you have to go into somebody's property to check. It's your statutory duty to check and see if an underground storage tank is leaking and contaminating water supplies, and the property owner comes running out with a gun and waves it around, yells obscenities, and says, if you... you know, not only get off my property, but if you ever come back, I'll shoot you. Now, it's not unusual for me to sometimes help our client agencies get entry orders when somebody just says, no, I don't want to let you on my property to do an investigation unless you have a court order. That's fine. I know how to do that. I do that quite a bit, and that's not a problem. But this guy's saying, not only don't come on my property, but if you come back, I'm going to shoot you. We don't have any remedy for that right now. And we were talking to different agency people. I know ODFW staff sometimes is unable to enforce, for example, the fish passage statutes because people won't let them on the property. They live out in those neighborhoods. It's not like Portland people going out every quarter to investigate and then go back home. They're folks that live in the neighborhoods. There was an agency staff over in Eastern Oregon who was involved in an enforcement case, and he was in a bar watching a football game one night, and the husband of the attorney representing the violator came in and started verbally assaulting him and wouldn't let him alone, verbally harassing him, and then finally assaulted him because he was doing his job. When the agencies come to us and say, what can we do to stop this? We don't have a tool. And we spend a lot of time looking for tools, and it simply isn't there. And after the fact, criminal prosecution is not satisfactory. And so what this bill does is propose a mechanism for agencies or the actual staff person who's subject to this harassment to seek injunctive relief that could be enforced through either civil or criminal contempt.
All right. Questions? Senator Burry.
On the ground, how would this work? If someone got an injunction against someone, would they come and put them in jail, or would they issue a restraining order? What would happen?
What we envision would be a temporary restraining order at first, or preliminary injunctive relief, or if necessary, a full permanent injunctive relief. And I think the way it would work, say, for example, the person I was talking about who wanted to go on the property to inspect the underground storage tank, the guy says, come back, I'll shoot you. So we go into court and ask for a restraining order prohibiting this individual from these kinds of threats. This isn't just anti-government. You know, we don't like government stuff. Prohibiting them from these threats. If it continues, then the next step would be to seek a civil or criminal contempt order. But we also think that usually when people are angry like this, or people coming into offices, into agency field offices, they're mad about, say, the Board of Forestry has enforced something and they're really angry about the forest practices statute, they come in and yelling and screaming at the secretaries or the receptionist. We want to be able to stop this person from coming in and doing this kind of harassment. If they do it again, then they may be facing a court order. What I started to say is I think usually what you'll see is a letter from our office attaching a statute that says don't do this. You can't do this. If you do this, we're going to get a restraining order, and if you fail to comply, we're going to see you in jail. I think that often will be sufficient, but right now we don't even have that threat. Does that answer?
Well, yeah, sort of. I mean, it seems to me that this kind of overlaps. I mean, if somebody threatens to shoot you, it seems to me that there's other statutes that would apply.
We couldn't find anything. There is criminal prosecution for these items that are listed here in the handout that I provide in my statement. I went ahead and included the statutory language so you could look at it for your convenience. But yes, it is a misdemeanor crime to do these sorts of things. But that means the agency staff has to go to a district attorney. First of all, we all know they're overloaded. And then it's after the fact. And it may be 18 months before you could ever get any kind of a criminal prosecution. And in the meantime, what is this person, what do our public servants do? Or you're a board of forestry person and this one menacing person comes in every day. I mean, sorry, not every day. Every meeting, every time there's a board meeting, someone comes in and threatens individual board members. We want to stop this person from doing that, not just get a DA to try and put him in jail.
I think this is because our time is running short.
Okay.
You've submitted some written information. I want to ask the committee to read through that and
all right.
Come up with some additional questions because as you're talking to me here, I've got a few procedural issues and some thoughts coming in my mind in terms of it doesn't look like you have to have a conviction.
Right.
For any of these
we definitely
crimes.
Do not want that requirement.
Just the elements.
The elements, yes.
I'd be interested when you come back to know a little bit more about how you would demonstrate that and if it's some kind of an affidavit, you know, supporting
okay.
the order, or whatever it would be.
Okay.
Because you, I mean, I wouldn't want this kind of a situation to be applied to someone who, where there was no merit. Where it was not merited.
Oh, yes, you know. Definitely. We wouldn't either. We're too busy.
I mean, we have people that come into our offices here who we find sometimes offensive, but that doesn't necessarily mean we'd want to.
Right. No, these are pretty egregious situations that have been happening.
All right, thank you. We're going to close public hearing
right.
on Senate Bill.
Thank you.
346. I got one little tiny issue here, not with you.
All right, thanks.
And it's a work session on Senate Bill 126. Council, if you could, I'm assuming this is fairly quick. We have some amendments to this bill. It was up for public hearing previously.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senate Bill, I'm sorry, you can stay there, Carly. I apologize. Senate Bill 126 was before the Committee for Public Testimony, I think a week ago, and we had one amendment, I think, that is before you. If you'll remember, this is the bill that allows a court to order the parents to pay supervision fees for a youth. In the course of the questioning by the committee, y'all have the dash one amendments.
Oh, we're struggling. I don't have them.
I don't have them.
Don't have them.
I have them either. This isn't going to work.
Okay.
Okay, we'll hold this over to Monday also. Sorry, Carl.
Sorry,
Carl. And close the work session.
Can we go on board with the amendments? Does that change them?
And
can we, Ingrid, did they change on the amendments on the bill?
You haven't seen the amendments? Okay, we're adjourned.